You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're going to talk about whether Canada is a country that let a mass murderer walk around free among us and indoctrinate young minds in a university classroom, or whether Canada is a country that was complicit with torturing an innocent man with relentless persecution for the last 17 years. Which is it? Is this guy a terrorist or a scapegoat?
It doesn't look good at the moment for Hassan.
And then I hear a big knocking on the door. I open the door and I see all this SWAT team.
Wait for it. Here's what we knew about the story of Hassan Diab from newspaper articles. This is what we knew before we took a crack at it. Story starts in 1980 when somebody detonates a bomb outside of a synagogue in Paris on Rue Copernic.
C'était un jour normal, c'était le vendredi soir, le jour du Shabbat.
He told us it was a normal day. He was with his brother. Then, at around 6:30 p.m., Pascal heard this sound. He felt the ground trembling. Shards of glass fell from the windows above him.
Parts of the ceiling crumbled. Pieces of the wall were blown off. Dust and debris everywhere.
Et il y avait un rideau de flammes qui séparait la synagogue de la rue.
He remembers seeing a curtain of flames rising between the synagogue and the street. And outside, there was chaos.
L'explosion a eu lieu aux alentours de 18h45 à la synagogue israélite libérale de la rue Copernic, au numéro 24 de cette...
If it had been any other Friday, hundreds of Jews would have been exiting that synagogue. But services ran late that day, so only four people were killed and dozens more injured. The entire country is outraged by this. Nothing like this has happened in decades. It's been a safe country for Jewish people since the Holocaust. There are mass demonstrations. People think that it's neo-Nazis behind it. But as the police follow the evidence, they become convinced that this is a different kind of violence. This is violence in the name of a free Palestine.
The police's investigation into the far right had hit a wall. All 83 far-right members that were arrested after the Copernic attack had solid alibis and were later released. And when Jack and his team put together the other clues they had, the witness statements and the way the attack was carried out, they realized something. This theory that had gripped the entire country, that the attack was an escalation from smaller neo-Nazi activities in the months prior, was probably wrong.
Quelque chose qui ne collait pas bien avec la piste d'extrême droite, déjà, et qui nous orientait évidemment vers le Moyen-Orient.
That was when the direction of the investigation started turning away from the far right and towards the Middle East.
And then the case goes cold, disappears from the headlines for decades. Until in 2007, this guy shows up to teach his university course. He's a sociology professor at Carleton University in Ottawa. His name is Hassan Diab. And he notices somebody sitting among his students in the lecture hall, somebody he does not recognize as one of his students. Turns out the stranger is a reporter from France. He approaches the professor after class and he asks him, "Professor Diab, did you know that you are a suspect in the Copernic synagogue bombing?" And that's where this professor's troubles begin. A year later, a SWAT team busts into his house. There is an extended extradition fight. There is incarceration in France. At one point, it seems that the whole case has fallen apart and he has returned to Canada without facing trial. Terrible ordeal, but at least it's behind him, right? No. France comes after him again, but this time they don't even try to extradite him back to France. They put him on trial in absentia, and they convict him. Hassan Diab is now a convicted terrorist, a convicted mass murderer, just walking around Ottawa, living his life among us. To some, he is a scapegoat, living a compromised, precarious, fearful existence, a sword forever dangling over his head. But to others, his freedom is an outrage. He's just snubbing his nose at justice, at his victims, and teaching a course at Carleton on social justice. He's infecting young students with the woke mind virus, as per an outraged Elon Musk tweet the other week. So which is it? What genre does this story belong in? Is this like that movie Hurricane or In the Name of the Father? Is this a story of persecution and scapegoating, an innocent man falsely accused? Watch him suffer. Will he be vindicated? Or does this belong in a different genre? Is this the story of a murderer walking among us, like the Jinx, or a murderer who you can just like sit down next to and talk to, like Silence of the Lambs? I did not know. And that is what is thrilling about investigative journalism. Ideally, if you're doing it right, I think. I mean, if you did know, why bother launching an investigation? You just have to dive in and see where it goes. Let the story tell itself to you. And that was my only condition when I greenlit the pitch for the Kopernik affair. These two reporters wanted us to fund this deep dive project, what would turn out to be a year and a half of investigation that would take them to France, to Ottawa, that would see them digging into declassified Stasi files, searching for lost Israeli intelligence documents, combing through historical records in Lebanon, court documents, hunting down people who were involved over 40 years ago, hunting them down one by one. This is just a tremendous undertaking. Now, given who these two reporters are, I knew that they could do that work and do it well. Dana Balut has reported for The Wall Street Journal. You may have heard her on This American Life. Alex Atak reports for The Guardian. He has since done this excellent podcast called Black Box that you might have heard. There was no question about their abilities. But what were their intentions? Did they already have their minds made up? Or were they truly interested in looking for the truth, whatever it might be? Free Hassan Diab was already a fashionable cause among parts of the Canadian left, but I had no interest in funding a piece of advocacy. Jail Hassan Diab is, again, an angry demand of everyone from Pierre Poilievre to the B'nai B'rith to Elon Musk, but I had no interest in funding a piece of predetermined rage bait. They would need to go wherever the facts took them and tell the world whatever they found. Turns out that's exactly what they had in mind as well. And as it turns out, the story that they found does not fit into any of those genres. And it's a story that is not yet over. Listen, our series, The Kopernik Affair, launches this week. You might have heard the first episode of The Kopernik Affair when we gave you a sneak peek, sneak listen. Now we will release the entire series, one episode at a time each week, on our new Canada Land Investigates feed. This show is just excellent, and I strongly encourage you to press pause on me right now and go subscribe to The Kopernik Affair. You already have your podcast app open. Just do it. Search for The Kopernik Affair. Thank me later. Okay, back now. In a moment, I'm going to sit down with Dana and Alex, and you're going to hear something that you won't hear them do on the Kopernik Affair series. They're going to talk about themselves as journalists, about why these two non-Canadians brought this Canadian story to Canada Land, why they dedicated a year and a half to it, and how their investigation became one of the most challenging and revealing projects they've ever taken on. Wait for it. Hi, Dana.
Hi, Jesse.
Hi, Alex.
Hey, Jesse.
Hassan Diab has become a cause. The cause of getting him deported to France and thrown back in jail is an important cause to people like Elon Musk and Pierre Poilievre. Mm-hmm. I think because they are anti-woke and they see the freedom of Hassan Diab as evidence of Canada as a country that's in the grip of woke lunacy. Hassan Diab is also a cause for groups like Independent Jewish Voices and other anti-Zionist groups. Vindicating Hassan Diab to them is a cause that they see as connected to their larger cause. Hassan Diab is not a cause. He's a guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's a person. And at the root of this is the question of whether or not he is a person who detonated a bomb in 1980 on Rue Copernic in Paris and killed four people. Or if he was a person who was in Beirut writing university exams at the time that that bomb went off.
Mm-hmm.
The two of you just spent a year and a half trying to figure out which of those guys he is. Why?
Dana and I both used to live in Lebanon. Dana's Lebanese. I lived there for a few years. We've always worked together on stories about the Middle East, about the Arab diaspora around the world. And we saw the initial news reporting coming out of this after his trial in France in April 2023, and he was found guilty in absentia. But I think for us to come to it at the time we did and see clearly that, you know, there's two very, very far apart narratives of what happened here. And I think what was interesting for us was to try and figure out, well, you know, which one of these, I don't want to say which one of these is the truth, but how close can we get to figuring out which one of these narratives is the truth?
Yeah, I think it's that exact dichotomy that you painted, Jesse, that makes this story so interesting, because it's quite rare to have such vastly different opinions about this one man and this one day. And the day is like 40 years ago.
There's sort of the surface level, which is shocking. Like, he's a convicted killer and he's just like living and walking around.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's like a series of eyebrow raises where you're like, tried in absentia. That's strange. And then my next question is like, well, if he's convicted, like France, that's not a joke of a legal system and we have an extradition treaty. So, well, why? And then you dig into it and you read that, well, he was in prison for years. He was in jail. And it kind of just keeps going from there. And before you know it, you're down the rabbit hole. And I found myself as compelled by this story as you guys.
Hi, Alex. I'm on the plane from L.A. to Ottawa.
On my way to visit Hassan Diab in Ottawa, I was nervous. We'd been speaking with Hassan for months over Zoom at this point. We'd interviewed lawyers, victims of the attack, magistrates. We'd read hundreds of pages of court documents, testimonies, and evidence.
I just don't know what to expect.
When I traveled to meet him at his home, I was there to ask difficult questions, sure. But I was also there to get a sense of the man. Who is Hassan Diab? What's his version of this story? I mean, the man Alex and I had spoken to over Zoom seemed harmless. But this constant thought lingered in the back of my mind. This man is convicted by French prosecutors for the murder of four innocent people. And he was still basically a stranger to me.
Hi, Hassan.
Good. How are you doing, guys? Sorry, I missed your call. It looks like the telephone was upstairs.
Oh, good. And
Hassan looks exactly how you might expect a sociology professor to look. Short, neat hair, square, wire-framed glasses.
I was born in Beirut, Lebanon. At the early childhood, I was in the sport activities in general, mainly football. I liked to play football. I still remember even the names of the First League.
There's another thing that really made me want to publish the story. The opportunity to pursue a whodunit, did he do it or didn't he do it story, in which it's possible for you, Dana, to like hop on a plane, fly to Ottawa, and sit down in the house of a convicted terrorist bomber. Without any limitations on what you could ask, no real limitations on the time that he would spend with you, to just sit inches away from this guy and ask him anything. I remember your first impression, but our feelings about him and your feelings about him have changed, and not in just one direction. It's been a real process. So I wonder if you recall what your first impression that you shared. Do you remember that?
I've reported on murder, on terrorism in the past. I've even spoken to people that are, I don't know about convicted, but at least suspected of things that are similar to this. Hassan is different because he's a character. Like, let's start off by the fact that he is a sociology professor. I didn't know what to make of him. I think he's very dad-ish in a lot of ways. You know, he's a dad of four kids, and he has two young kids that live with him. Welcoming, funny, very sarcastic in times where you're like, I'm not sure this humor is working, you know, but yeah, it takes time to get used to him and his humor as well. There's a lot that I can say about Hassan. Obviously, us both being Lebanese, there was that common factor, but I don't know. You can remind me what my first thoughts were, but it took me a while to get used to him, I'll say that.
Yeah, none of that is what you said after first meeting him.
What did I say?
I recall that you found him incredibly frustrating.
Oh, yeah, also.
That he couldn't answer a straight question. You labored to come up with a list of pointed questions, and you wanted to be a very diligent journalist and be tough and not let him take you on a journey, and that you were going to ask him specific, hard yes or no questions. And he gave discursive, long, looping answers where you lost your bearings as to what you were even initially trying to get to the bottom of.
Yeah.
I remember you expressing that frustration, and I remember you also saying, I think he's hiding things.
Mm. Yeah, I think the looping around made me think, like, are you hiding something? But then the more you speak to him, you see that's just how he speaks. There was one point in the interview where he was like, you know, my parents, they never really answer a question. They just tell you a story before they ever answer the question. And in my head, I'm like, oh, you are just like your parents. Like, nothing has changed. Yeah, but I think that sentiment holds true. It's rare to get a yes or no from Hassan because he also has a lot of memories and wants to describe things in very specific details.
I think there's two ways of looking at Hassan's demeanor, right? And we kind of struggled with this throughout the series. There's one way of looking at it, which is like he is giving you these long, rambling, tangential answers to deliberately try and take you away from your original question or to distract you from what it was that you were trying to find out. There's also another, in my opinion, equally valid way of looking at it, which is like this guy has been subject to, you know, decades now, interrogations, time spent in prison, constant surveillance, and that could just be how his mind works now.
Yeah. I mean, there's a third option, which is that he is hiding things, not necessarily because he bombed the synagogue on Rue Kopernik, but because he knows how certain information about his past might be used by his persecutors. Like, you know, very pointed questions about what his history with militant politics was in his youth. Did he ever hang out with people like that? Did he ever shoot guns with student radicals? You ultimately got him to concede. He was evasive, but ultimately he did concede that, yeah, you know, he did know some student militants in Beirut, and that, and maybe he even shot a gun or two at like a Coke can with them. And it occurs to me, like, if he is innocent of the bombing, but he did do those things, it's understandable why he'd be withholding, why he'd be cagey. Or, you know, just like going back to where you started, Alex, there's scenario one, which is that he wasn't answering questions directly because he had things to hide, and he had things to hide because he's guilty. You'll both remember that the original title for this series was going to be The Trials of Hassan Diab, but ultimately we all agreed that this is not a story that's just about Hassan, who may or may not have even had anything to do with the event at the core of this. What do we know for sure? For sure, a bomb was detonated outside of that synagogue in 1980. For sure, four people were killed. For sure, dozens of people were injured and hundreds of people's lives were forever changed. You did everything that you could to get the voices of the survivors of that awful event into this series, to give them a chance to respond to Hassan and to be heard. And most of them wouldn't do it. And I can understand why. I mean, the survivors of this bombing, like, this is a closed case to them. You know, they've been through it. You know, for decades, this was a cold case. There was not even a suspect for the authorities to charge. And then finally, they are told that the cops have found the guy, and it takes years, but he is convicted, and they were satisfied that the justice had been done. So here you come, and opening everything up for public review and contemplation through a podcast. Why would they help with that? You know, you have to understand and respect their decision to not participate. But that was not unanimous. You did speak with a man whose mother was killed that day by that bomb, Oren Shagrir.
My mother was just a tourist in Paris.
Her name was Eliza Shagrir. She was a film editor. Eliza was in Paris with Oren's brother. The two of them were on their way to meet a family friend when she stopped off at a grocery store on Kopernik Street, a quiet street in an affluent neighborhood in the west of the city.
Then my mother, when they arrived to the corner of Kopernik and Lauriston, my mother told my brother that she will just go to the fruit store on Kopernik Street to bring some figs, and that she will meet my brother in a few minutes. But this was the last time my brother saw her.
I think one of our first challenges was trying to get people that were there that day. So in the record of the case and in the case files, there is a long, long list of everyone that was there that filed basically claims of ways that they were hurt during the bombing. There's like a list of at least 100 people, probably maybe a little less than that, of people that were injured or had a family member killed. And so Alex and I went almost one by one with those names. A lot of them had died. So we were looking for some of the children of those people. A lot of the people listed were then children that are now grown adults. And we tried everyone, whether it's finding them on Facebook or finding them on LinkedIn. I can't tell you the number of messages that we've sent to people.
I've thought a lot about the dynamics that go into these interviews. You know, when you speak with Oren, for example, what's at play in that conversation? He's talking to you about something so traumatic, the murder of his mother. He has made a calculation that it's better for him to be heard than not.
Mm.
But that required him trusting you as well. Like in the telling of stories, you as the journalists have all the levers, you know, what to use, what not to use, what music to put behind him,
yeah,
who you might talk to about him. And I know that you took that responsibility really seriously. Like, would you be able to look them in the eye after this is done?
Mm-hmm.
Could you answer their questions? So how is that all sitting with you now that the series is wrapped and filed?
I mean, it's a hard one to answer, actually. Honestly, it doesn't feel great that you have all of these people's experiences, you know, they've shared with you, like, some of the sort of worst moments of their lives, and that ends with, and here's who I believe is responsible for this. And then in your series, you know, a big part of your series is questioning that. It isn't a good feeling, honestly. I think all we can say is that we treated everybody in the series the same and with the same degree of fairness and accuracy, and I'm happy with how we landed on all of that. I always knew I would feel this way when the series was done, that I knew I would feel uncomfortable about the idea of Oren listening to it, or even the idea of Hassan listening to it. It's not comfortable, you know. Everybody, you they come to you, they're trusting you, and then you kind of, as you say, go away and do your thing with it, and like, all you can put in the podcast is what you can stand up with evidence and testimony. And I think we did the best we could, but there's no clean answer, honestly. It's still something I feel uncomfortable about.
And what about Hassan listening to it? Has he listened to it?
Yeah, he has listened to it. And my sense is that he was disappointed in how it came out. Purely, this is just my feeling, but I think maybe he maybe he thought that it might be more of an advocacy project. Obviously, we were never misleading about what our intentions were. He always knew who we were speaking to. As with everybody in the series, we made it completely clear that we were fully intending on telling both sides of this very complex story. I don't think he enjoyed sitting there and listening to two whole episodes about all of the evidence that the French had compiled against him and all of the people who are saying they believe him to be a murderer. So yeah, I think he was disappointed in the series. But we're still talking to him, still replying to our emails, so.
Well, I'm not shocked that he's still trying to be heard, because Hassan is not out of the woods yet.
The hypothetical scenario that sort of keeps me up at night, I run it both ways. What if we publish this and then it turns out that he's completely innocent, like conclusively. Somebody else confesses to it and there's rock hard evidence. And you go and you listen to everything that we published knowing that. And then I flip that. What if it becomes clear that he did it and that this guy who we got to know, and you find out that he's a killer. And then you go and you listen to it again. And the hope is that it does withstand either of those outcomes.
I think what brings me comfort is that we spoke to absolutely anyone that would talk to us.
Yeah.
We reached out to any name that we've seen in the court documents, we reached out to, and yeah, spoke to anyone that would say yes. There isn't a single document that we did not read multiple times. In making this podcast, I think Alex and I would keep rereading the same court documents over and over again and find new things and change. And, you know, we kept reminding ourselves of the facts of the case. And I think that brings me comfort, is that with the information that we had and with the testimonies and the interviews that people allowed us, and yes, I don't take that trust lightly, people trusted us with this story. I hope we did the best of our ability to make sure that those stories and people's narratives were told in fair and accurate ways. And that brings me comfort, because I do think that we did that. I mean, at least we did the best we could as journalists.
It doesn't look good at the moment for Hassan. I think from Hassan and his supporters' perspective, the thing they're worried about is coming true much quicker than they maybe thought it would happen. And one of their biggest worries is that there would be a change in government. You know, Justin Trudeau in the past showed support for Hassan Diab.
Hassan Diab, we have to recognize, first of all, that what happened to him never should have happened. This is something that obviously was an extremely difficult situation to go through for himself, for his family.
He went quiet on that after he said it and didn't ever say anything about it again. But they had this feeling that, you know, as long as Justin Trudeau is in power, I'll be in limbo, but, you know, nothing's going to move. I'm not going to be extradited to France again. Obviously now that's set to change very soon. It's very likely that Pierre Poilievre will get in, and, you know, Pierre Poilievre has voiced support. He's openly questioned why Hassan Diab is still living freely in Canada. And so you have to imagine that, given that ultimately the person that gives their stamp of approval to an extradition request from France is somebody who's appointed by the government, it's a political appointment. Yeah, you'd have to imagine that in the future, Pierre Poilievre's conservative government wouldn't look at Hassan's case very charitably. And if France were to come with another extradition request, you would imagine it would be much easier for them to get Hassan extradited again.
At which point, the newsreader might imagine the extradition of Hassan Diab ends with his life in prison. But that's also not where this would end. What actually would happen next, Dana?
If he gets extradited to France again, and we do believe that there is already an extradition request on behalf of France, if he does get extradited again, then he would face trial again in France. That's what would happen. He would face trial again.
The whole thing starts again.
Yeah, it does.
Mm-hmm.
The weighing of the truth, the weighing of the evidence, going back to Lebanon, back to Rue Kopernik, it all starts again.
Yeah.
And it would be raking over the same evidence that has basically been in the dossier for